Ahmed Rashid, welcome to the Kentucky Author Forum. It is a great honor and privilege to be with you this evening. I actually wanted to start by reading just a very small excerpt from your latest book, Pakistan on the Brink. You wrote, "Both have had enough of the relationship. Both are defiant, yet each needs the other. Neither wants to revive the relationship under false pretenses, yet neither can muster enough vision or assume enough responsibility to discuss a new paradigm. At times, each side convinces itself that it can do without the other, which, of course, is wishful thinking." Now, I think one could be forgiven for thinking that you were perhaps describing a really bad marriage. But actually, you're describing arguably the most important bilateral relationship in the world. Tell me, why is this such a dysfunctional relationship?
Well, Clarissa, it's become so. I mean, initially after 9/11, we had a military regime which supported the U.S., a major aim which was at that time to find al-Qaeda. And Pakistan supported that very strongly and delivered something like 500 al-Qaeda to the United States. But at the same time, Pakistan was hedging its bets in Afghanistan and was giving protection to the Taliban. And that's something that President Bush never asked about, never asked any questions, never raised the issue. And of course, after the election of President Obama, the Taliban issue becomes really important. And the real threat to Afghanistan's stability becomes not al-Qaeda, but the Taliban. And there, Pakistan remains giving sanctuary to the Taliban.
Now, just explain that to us for a second, because I think that's really confusing to people. Why would Pakistan be giving sanctuary to the Taliban? What's in it for them?
Well, first of all, you know, they had a very long relationship with the Taliban. Pakistan supported the Taliban in the 90s during the civil war in Afghanistan. And if you remember, there was the Northern Alliance, which was fighting the Taliban, which was supported by Pakistan's regional enemies, India, Iran, Russia. And the fear of Pakistan and the military in particular was that after 9/11, the Indians will come back into Afghanistan, the Indian, Iranian, Russian influence will grow alongside the American presence. And so the Taliban were like a sort of hedge. And at the same time, remember that there was a very strong feeling that the Americans would leave Afghanistan very quickly and move to Iraq. And that once the Iraq invasion started, there was a lot of speculation that the Americans would just pull out of Afghanistan, in which case Pakistan wanted a proxy force to be able to keep in reserve in case the Americans pulled out and to prevent its enemy India from rearming and re-supporting other ethnic groups in Afghanistan.
Is it possible that the U.S. didn't realize from the get-go that this was going on, that Pakistan wanted to be assured that its interests would be protected by essentially supporting the insurgency?
I think there were huge mistakes made by the Bush administration. They had a very single-track obsession with al-Qaeda, not looking at the regional issues, which President Obama has tried to look at. In other words, the tension between Pakistan and India, between Pakistan and Iran, not giving... Bush never gave importance to the Taliban, although President Karzai frequently would tell him that, you know, my problem is not al-Qaeda, my problem is actually the Taliban, and you're not doing anything about it. And it was only, you know, really late 2007-08 when, you know, the Taliban issue became so important.
You mentioned al-Qaeda, and of course, that was one of the primary objectives in the war in Afghanistan. Just 1 year ago, almost exactly, Osama bin Laden was found to be living in Pakistan, in the city of Abbottabad, which is just a few hours from the capital. It's home to one of the biggest military academies. Is it possible that no one in the Pakistani government had, or security forces, had any idea that bin Laden was living there?
Well, we don't know the answer to that. But quite frankly, bin Laden was living in Pakistan for maybe 9 years. He changed houses three or four times. His wife delivered three children or four children in government hospitals. Now, clearly, I mean, you know, the indication would be that somebody knew something. or the other. It seems very hard to believe that nobody knew nothing. But the whole problem is that this is a question that most Pakistanis are asking also. I mean, the Americans are asking, the world is asking, but Pakistanis are asking also. And unfortunately, neither the government nor the military nor the intelligence services have given adequate answers to this. There is a commission of inquiry that is still going on in Pakistan, but frankly, nobody expects it to deliver any of the goods as far as who knew what, when, or how.
I was just in Pakistan for the anniversary of bin Laden's death, and I was so struck by the fact that most of the Pakistanis who I spoke to, instead of feeling outraged that bin Laden had been living there, you described, they were outraged that America had violated their sovereign territory by the raid that led to the death of bin Laden. And many of them didn't even believe that bin Laden had actually been killed or that he was even living in Pakistan. What is that about?
You see, this is the tragedy that, I mean, you know, a whole new narrative, which is basically anti-American, anti-democracy, has been really filtered into the mainstream media, into the political debate in Pakistan by fundamentalists and extremists who are very close to Al-Qaeda or sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. Now, for example, if you take, you know, his death, initially, when President Obama phoned President Zardari in Pakistan, the Pakistani army chief, president, prime minister, all gave congratulations to the Americans and said, you know, well done, he's an enemy of ours, and, you know, that was a very good move. And then 4 days later, and then there's silence from the Pakistani side. And 4 days later, what happens is that there is enormous push from the bottom, from the fundamentalists and extremists saying, no, this was an intrusion into Pakistani territory by the Americans. Mid-level army officers raise this issue with the army chief, and there's an almighty fear within the political establishment that there might be a revolt from below of extremists linked to people in the army. And on day five, for the first time, you get the army chief giving a statement saying, it was nothing to do with, bin Laden's presence was not about a failure of Pakistan. In fact, it was all the fault of the Americans for attacking Pakistani soil. So the essential question, which was, you know, was anyone complicit in hiding him? And if nobody was complicit, then were the intelligence agencies totally incompetent? Neither of these questions get answered. And in fact, the debate is shifted away from these two key questions, which have still not been answered.
When you take into consideration exactly what you've just said, and you look at how Pakistan is known to be supporting the Taliban or providing them with safe havens, what reason does the U.S. have to trust Pakistan? Should the U.S. trust Pakistan?
Well, you know, I think the issue here is that, you know, I don't think the U.S. really, in the long term, has a choice in the region. Pakistan is a nuclear weapon state. It is nearly 200 million people, and it occupies a geographical position that is absolutely critical. It's on the Gulf. It neighbors Afghanistan. It neighbors India. It neighbors Central Asia. It's not something that can really be ignored. Now, I think, you know, I mean, what I suggest, you know, certainly in my book is that the one way that you can rebuild the relationship is by Pakistan has been asking for a long time for America to talk to the Taliban. That is something that the Americans have now adopted. Unfortunately, America adopted this new policy about 9 months ago at a time when the relationship was already sliding with Pakistan. Somehow, this relationship has to be rebuilt on a common agenda. Now, that common agenda is not necessarily regarding India or regarding anything else, but there can be a common agenda between America and Pakistan on trying to bring peace to Afghanistan. And that's where I think the future lies. But there is now another problem, and that is that there's a huge crisis inside Pakistan itself, which has nothing to do with the United States. There's an economic crisis, there's a social and political crisis, there are two insurgencies in the country that are going on right now, and to which the government really has no answers. So there's a huge domestic crisis, which is why I say Pakistan on the brink. Pakistan is on the brink for itself because of all these other problems.
You talk about, you know, the common interest of some form of peace in Afghanistan, but to what extent does the U.S.'s vision of a peaceful Afghanistan and Pakistan's vision of a peaceful Afghanistan, to what extent do those visions converge?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question because, I mean, if you look at the moment, the lack of trust. The U.S. believes that what Pakistan wants, and the Afghans believe this too, Pakistan wants to have major influence in Afghanistan after the Americans leave. Now, that is something that is not acceptable to the Afghans at all, because they've had a lot of Pakistani interference in Afghanistan over the years, and they're tired and fed up with it. It's not acceptable to India, it's not acceptable to Iran, it's not acceptable to any of the neighbors. So I think what is needed is that the U.S., and again, this is something that, you know, certainly when President Obama came in, he had tasked his main ambassador for Afghanistan, Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, with this task of trying to aim for a regional solution, which was essentially that all the neighboring states of Afghanistan, by the way, has six direct neighbors. It's a landlocked country. And all of these neighbors have interfered in Afghanistan at one point or the other. And so the idea was that you would get the six neighbors to agree to a non-interference pact in Afghanistan so that when the Americans left, you would not get all these neighbors plunging back in again, arming the warlords, arming their proxies, and fueling the civil war. Now, you know, this is something that Pakistan would agree to, but only if the other neighbors agree to it also. Likewise, the other neighbors are saying, well, you know, we're not going to allow Pakistan to have a full monopoly over influence in Afghanistan. It has to be equally shared. So we need, we need a regional agreement amongst all the neighboring states. No one neighbor is willing to give the other neighbor the clout to interfere.
Let's talk a moment about the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke. You mention him quite a bit in your book, and it's interesting. You describe meeting President Obama, President Karzai, President Zardari, but in some ways I feel that Holbrooke almost emerges as one of the strongest characters in your book. What was so special about the work that he was doing, and why has no one else really been able to replicate it since his passing?
Well, you know, I think Holbrooke, of course, was one of America's best-known, finest diplomats for several decades. And he was entrusted, really, to do two or three things, to pursue a regional agreement, to engage with Pakistan and end the safe havens that the Taliban were enjoying, and ultimately to talk to the Taliban. And he really got it. Strategically speaking, if you read other people's books or talk to other people, certainly there's a lot of criticism of Holbrooke. He was arrogant at times. He was overwhelming at times. But you know, he put together a team of something like 40 people in Washington from all the departments of government, including the CIA and the military and the Treasury, and he really saw this problem as not just, you know, isolated bits that have to be brought together, but as a whole, which involved Pakistan, Afghanistan, even Iran. At that time, you know, there was the hope that perhaps the Americans could start a dialogue even with Iran about Afghanistan separately from the nuclear issue, which was already a bone of contention. So he was a very powerful figure, and I think, you know, he got it strategically. He engaged with Pakistan. I mean, many Pakistanis asked the question today, if Holbrooke had been alive today, would this collapse of relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan have occurred?
Would it have occurred?
Well, I don't think he would have allowed it to occur in the way it has. I don't think it would be as bad as it is today. Unfortunately, what happened after his death was that the team was broken up. The State Department, he had a replacement, but the divisions that divisions erupted within the Obama administration, particularly between the Defense Department, the military on one side, and the State Department on the other. And the real issue at stake was the talking to the Taliban. The military were opposed, essentially, to talking to the Taliban. And you can understand that. They were fighting with them. They were at war with them. I mean, they were not going to support the idea of talks. But Holbrooke, before he left, had left his legacy of the need to talk to the Taliban. Unfortunately, the State Department has not been really empowered enough to oversway the military. And so this division has really stymied American policy.
You said that Holbrooke believed, at least, that he was hated by some people with the administration, that he was viewed as something of a nuisance, in fact. And you talk a lot about these internal divisions. Can you elaborate on what those tensions were about?
You see, the very first division, if you remember, when Obama appoints Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, of course, was his rival in the presidential campaign, and she's appointed Secretary of State, and then she brings in all her own people into the State Department, which, of course, included Richard Holbrooke. And essentially, there was a division between the White House, which was Obama-led, and the State Department, that was Hillary Clinton-led. And for the first year or two, they were really at odds with one another. And if the two principals were not at odds, certainly the staff, below them were at odds with one another. The White House was not listening to Holbrooke. Holbrooke felt that, Obama was not giving him the time of day. For example, Richard Holbrooke never had a one-to-one session with President Obama.
Never.
And he resented that, naturally. I mean, he was, the most engaged in the most important diplomatic effort of the U.S. government. He's not able to speak to the president, on his own. So there was, first of all, this division. And then over time, unfortunately, by the time Holbrooke dies, that division had actually healed. And then we get a new division, which is essentially between the military and the State Department, which was nothing to do with Obama and Hillary Clinton, but more to do with policy and strategy in Afghanistan.
Let's talk a little bit about President Obama's strategy in Afghanistan. The tone, when I'm reading the book and your descriptions of watching this policy as it's unfolded for the last 3 years, there's a sense of disappointment there, almost, that there was a moment that was somehow missed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I think, again, Obama came in he wanted to pull out of Afghanistan, but at the same time, he wanted to push for both a military surge and a civilian surge. In other words, concentrate on trying to rebuild the Afghan economy, on improving social and welfare, building the infrastructure, roads, electricity, all these kinds of things, which basically had been neglected by Bush. The problem was that I think, there were a lot of mistakes in the implementation of this. The very first mistake was, of course, when he announced the surge, he also announced the date of withdrawal as being 2014. And that was a signal, both to the Taliban, to Al-Qaeda, to all the regional players, all the neighboring countries of Afghanistan, well, the Americans are going to be out of here. All we have to do is to hang on and prepare our forces. In 3 years, the Americans will be out. Now, I thought, that was a very big mistake. The other thing was that just as the military surge occurred from the American side, the Taliban also stepped up their offensive. The level of suicide bombings and attacks on U.S. forces, they all increased. So the civilian surge that had been, something like 1,000 civilian experts were hired by the U.S. government to send into Afghanistan to help with agriculture, road building, all this kind of stuff, which would have been incredibly useful and important for developing Afghanistan. And unfortunately, the insurgency stepped up, and the U.S. military couldn't provide security for these people to go in, and couldn't provide sufficient security for the kind of nation building that was required, and that was that the administration wanted to do. So, you know, again, this was another very good idea that fell by the wayside. And right now, a lot of these civilian experts are still, in fact, stuck in Kabul. They can't go to the villages. They can't go out because of the insurgency.
But I think a lot of us in the U.S. have a really hard time wrapping our head around how it is that so much blood has been shed, so many billions and billions of dollars have been spent, so many more troops. There's been a few surges in the past few years. Why are we not making more headway? Why hasn't there been an improvement in the security situation? Why can't these civilians go out to the villages, like you said, and get on with their work? It doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense.
Well, Clarissa, in one word, I would say, you know, the answer is Iraq. Iraq was such a distraction from the kind of resources and troops and money and issues and development and experts that should have gone to Afghanistan, all ended up in Iraq. And the real time frame to do something positive in Afghanistan was, of course, the insurgency doesn't begin till 2003, 2004. So you had 3 or 4 years in which, you know, there could have been a huge improvement in the economy and in other things. But unfortunately, the Bush administration decides it doesn't want to spend the money there. It doesn't want to put resources into Afghanistan because it's preparing for Iraq. So I think that was the real golden opportunity, you know, that was missed. Once the insurgency starts, you have basically the U.S. military and Karzai and other people warning the Bush administration that, look, this is now serious. The Taliban are now linked up with Al-Qaeda. They are fighting. And basically the Bush administration ignores the Taliban and still insists on capturing Al-Qaeda. And there's also really no policy towards Pakistan and the fact that the Taliban were being harbored in Pakistan. So by the time President Obama comes in, you really have, you know, the Taliban who start out their insurgency in one or two provinces in the south of the country. By the time Obama comes in, the insurgency is spread right across the country in all 34 provinces and is really a threat to everyone.
But in a sense, the answer really lies in Pakistan, because the fact that these terrorists or militants or whatever you would like to call them, that they have these safe havens in Pakistan. And I've met Taliban fighters who will describe going and spending their winters in Pakistan so that they can get some rest and stock up on weapons and
see their families.
Literally. I mean, it is, you know, how can you take out an insurgency when an insurgency has a home away from home?
Yeah.
In another country.
Again, you see, I think Richard Holbrooke was really trying to tackle this problem. It was not an issue that you could either threaten Pakistan or force it to you had to cajole it and persuade it and give it the right kind of incentives to become part of either getting the Taliban to talk to Karzai, talk to the Americans, or, you know, and ending these safe havens. And, you know, I think, again, if he had lived, I think, you know, Pakistan-U.S. relations and this whole Pakistan-Taliban relationship would have possibly been very different. Or, of course, if President Obama had given the same kind of attention to Pakistan that was required even after Holbrooke's death. So I think, unfortunately, you know, we see a real, meltdown in the relationship because, you know, that kind of attention was not there.
You talk a lot about that in your book as well, for all the various critiques of the Bush administration's handling of Afghanistan. You do say that President Bush and Laura Bush had a very sort of personal relationship with Afghanistan, that they were often hosting various Afghans at the White House, that he would have these regular video conferences with President Karzai. And the same does not seem to be true of President Obama. How important do you think that is?
Well, you know, I mean, in our part of the world, the personal relationship, I think, like everywhere else, is extremely important. And I think what happens is that because this administration has been so involved in trying to disengage itself from Afghanistan, That, you know, the personal rapport between the American president, the Afghan president, between, you know, Afghans generally, it really dissipates and disappears. And of course, the fact that, you know, President Obama has to be seen and was, of course, preoccupied with dealing with the U.S. economy. He comes in, there's a full-blown economic crisis. How would the American public have appreciated the fact that he was giving so much time or attention to Afghanistan at a time when the U.S. economy was going through such a crisis? So, I mean, again, I can understand his responsibilities and the problems he has, but there is no doubt that I think a lot of people in the region felt that the way, even though Bush was doing so many wrong things and many of his policies were really inadequate, but he had this personal PR and used the White House as a kind of tool to win support and sympathy. And that's lacking with President Obama.
Let's talk about their Afghan counterpart, President Hamid Karzai. I think in the U.S. we have a sense that we know there are associations with corruption with him, and I think there's a sense that he's been around for a very long time, and what has he really achieved? How much of a help or hindrance do you think Hamid Karzai, President Karzai, has been in terms of Afghanistan's progress?
Well, in the beginning, I've known him for a very long time. In the beginning, it was very difficult to find an Afghan leader who did not have blood on his hands, who had not, you know, carried out human rights abuses, who was not corrupt, who had not taken money from this or that neighbor, or was considered a stooge of this or that neighbor. And Karzai, you know, was perhaps, you know, the cleanest guy around at that time, was educated, was articulate, and was able to present an Afghan face to the international community, etc. But I think what happens is, first of all, as you said, he's been there for 10 years, far too long. Secondly, I think the other problem has been that he has failed to really build up a team of trustworthy people. And if you see the record, I mean, whether it's the presidency or his cabinet, the sackings and the coming and going of personnel is so rapid that, you know, people will come in for a few months and then be sacked. And there's just a failure to build up a proper team. He doesn't trust anyone now. And there are all sorts of people now inside the presidency and inside the cabinet who are giving conflicting advice. There are people saying, talk to the Taliban. There are people saying, don't talk to the Taliban. There are ministers saying, trust the Americans. Others are saying, don't trust the Americans. And, you know, I also, you know, you can well sympathize because of this security situation. This is a person who's lived in a palace, or the presidential palace, literally for the last 10 years, who has very rarely been able to go out.
Almost
a prison. I mean, what does that do to you mentally? I can't even imagine.
Well, when WikiLeaks first came out with their big leaks, there was mention that the CIA had described President Karzai as possibly suffering from bipolar disorder. You've spent a lot of time with him, and you know him better than most. I'm not so much asking whether or not he may be bipolar, but how does he respond to that level of scrutiny or critique from the U.S. and from the West, given that he's in something of an impossible situation?
He gets very emotional and very upset. And I mean, that's part of the problem, because then he gives public statements which either, you know, carry abuse against the Americans or against NATO or against his own allies, or he praises the Taliban, you know, at the wrong moment when the Taliban have just carried out a suicide bombing. And so this kind of criticism, you know, affects him greatly. Now, there's no doubt that, you know, corruption has increased enormously. Now, part of that reason is, of course, that so much money has come in, and so much money has been wasted, partly by the Americans themselves. The U.S. military machine is such an enormous machine. It spends billions and billions of dollars every week, every month. It's natural that there's going to be corruption and wastage in that whole process of, you know, you've got 100, you had 150,000 troops in Afghanistan. It was going to cost billions of dollars to keep them there. And, of course, a lot of that corruption is also rubbed off on the Afghans. Not to speak of the drugs trade, because the drugs trade is also fueling corruption amongst the Afghan elite. And a lot of people have made enormous sums of money through the drugs trade. So you have a double whammy here. You have these $600 billion has been spent by the Americans in Afghanistan since 2001. Now, you know, even if 5 or 10% of that money has gone into corruption, you can imagine. Plus the drugs trade, which is also $5 to $6 billion a year, is generated by the drugs trade. So there's enormous amount of possibilities here for corruption that has happened.
I spoke with a very wise Afghan general who said to me, the problem we have in Afghanistan at the moment is that there is no money in peace. There's no money in peace. The money's in war. That's everyone is getting a cut. Everyone is making a buck. You take out, you know, the U.S., you take out NATO, you take out all the civilian projects that are being funded there, and basically all we have left are drugs. Yeah. You talk also about NATO's failure to sort of implement an indigenous economy in Afghanistan. How much of a role has that played, and will that continue to play in trying to generate stability there?
Well, I this is really one of my very big concerns that, you know, as I mentioned, President Obama tried to develop a local indigenous economy that would be sustainable after the Americans withdraw. But that just hasn't been possible because of the insurgency. And Bush never did it. You know, the money that went into Afghanistan did not go to build an economy. We now have a problem where you've got tens of thousands of Afghans who are servicing the foreign troops. Once the foreign troops leave, all these Afghans who are really a new class almost. I mean, they're educated, they speak English, they're pro-democracy, pro-Western, anti-warlordism, anti-extremism. You know, this is the very class of people you want to sustain and keep going. These people are going to be without jobs. And this whole generation that has grown up in the last 10 years, under the American presence, are going to be literally without jobs. And this is of enormous concern in the region. You know, I often give this analogy. I traveled in Afghanistan in the 70s when I was very young. And in the 70s, when Afghanistan was a monarchy, it was a very, very poor country. It was much poorer than Pakistan or India. But, you know, they were self-sufficient in food. They had a small surplus which they could export. They only had three cities that had electricity. But nevertheless, you know, they were self-sustained. And I look for the fact, you know, has the Western presence in Afghanistan rebuilt the economy at least to the level of what it was in 1978? And the answer is no, you haven't. I mean, there is malnutrition now in 40% of the countryside in Afghanistan. People are either not growing food because they're growing opium, or there's insufficient food distribution, or, you know, food is too expensive. This was not the case in 1978.
But the Taliban surely bears a lot of the responsibility for that, particularly in terms of growing the drugs trade.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I mean, the Taliban have not allowed, you know, if there have been attempts by the Afghans and Western aid agencies to try and bring about a local economy, the Taliban have not allowed that to happen. And the Taliban, of course, benefit from the drugs trade does go to the Taliban because they tax it. And they protect the farmers who grow poppy, which becomes opium, which then becomes heroin. They take a cut from the farmers, they take a cut from the transporters of the opium out of the country, and then they are now involved in drug smuggling beyond Afghanistan's borders, in Pakistan, in Central Asia, to India and other places.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Taliban, seeing as you literally wrote the book on the Taliban, and you are very outspoken as well about what you believe is necessary in terms of facilitating a dialogue between the Taliban and the U.S. and Pakistan. I just wanted to read another small excerpt here. You said, "The Taliban are exhausted by the long war. They've suffered terrible casualties and they want to return home from the refugee camps in Pakistan. The older generation of Taliban realize that since they could not run the country in the 1990s, they will not be able to do so in the future. Rather than trying to grab power and then face international isolation and forfeit funds and aid, they now see the benefits of a coalition government with Karzai that would retain Western aid, legitimacy, and support." This is very interesting because to some people I think that might sound like, really? Do the Taliban really appreciate and understand all those things? Are they really that politically savvy? And my question to you, because you talk about the older generation specifically, A, what about the younger generation? And B, is the Taliban even a homogenous group in the way that you seem to imply?
Well, look, I mean, in addition to that, I would say what the Taliban, I think, are most scared of right now is another civil war after the Americans leave. And that is quite possible if there's no peace settlement. Another civil war between the Taliban, it would be a multi-dimensional civil war. It wouldn't just be a two-sided thing between the government and the Taliban, because the Northern Alliance, the warlords in the north, other ethnic groups, they would all get involved, and they would be armed by one neighbor or the other. And I think the Taliban want to avoid that. And the other main reason is that I think, again, the older generation know that they cannot govern the country. And they also know that if they try to seize Kabul, which, you know, a lot of speculation, the Americans will leave, the Taliban will come in and capture Kabul. Well, the Taliban know perfectly well that the West would walk away immediately. There would be no money for Afghanistan. And in 6 months, the people would be starving and they'd be blaming the Taliban for starving them. So I think, now, your question is very important, because clearly there's a lot of the young commanders in the Taliban have been influenced by Al-Qaeda. They believe in global jihad. They want to reimpose the whole Islamic system. They would shun any idea of a coalition with Karzai or something like that. It's a moot point. Are the Taliban a united force? We know that there are three or four major factions within the Taliban. But I still believe that the main Taliban shura, that is called the Quetta Shura, that is the central committee of the Taliban, which is based in Pakistan, and is still led by Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban who ruled Afghanistan in the 90s, he still carries enormous clout and prestige. Now, I don't think that if there is a settlement with Karzai and with the Americans, and Mullah Omar blesses that settlement or, you know, puts his hand on it and says, you know, this is what we believe in, I don't see other Taliban really being in a position to, kick that aside and say, no, we will continue fighting. As I say, I think, the Afghans are really, exhausted. They've been fighting for 30 years, three decades. And young and old are really tired, of this war. And I think, a chance has to be given. Let's see if these talks will work. I mean, there's no guarantee that the talks will work.
Well, they've already started, have they not? I mean, how far along are we?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, we're bogged down because, there's the talks started on the premise that there would be the Americans and the Taliban would talk to each other, and two things would happen. There would be the Taliban would be allowed to open an office in the Gulf Emirate of Qatar, and that there would be confidence-building measures on both sides. And the first confidence-building measure was that there would be this prisoner exchange between five Taliban who in Guantanamo would be released in exchange for an American soldier who's being held by the Taliban. And that has got bogged down, and it's been bogged down literally since January. There hasn't been a meeting between the Americans and the Taliban since January. And it's been very heavily bogged down because of differences in Washington. But also, there's no doubt that the Taliban have also used this opportunity to step up their attacks inside Kabul and, other major cities. So So far, you know, the talks have not been successful. Now, we are into an American election campaign. President Obama is not going to suddenly, release five leading Taliban figures from Guantanamo a few months before the election so that the Republicans can jump on him and say, you know, you're soft on terrorism, why are you doing this, etc. So unfortunately, we are now, you know, I wish, you know, this confidence-building measures and others had happened 6 months earlier. But now that we're in this election campaign, I fear very much that very little might happen before November.
So you believe that they're ready to come to the table and negotiate, that they won't necessarily try and grab all power, that they might be amenable to some kind of a, you know, power-sharing agreement with the Karzai government. But how can we trust them, A? And B, how can we trust, you know, some of the fundamental differences of culture that Americans have found so hard to get their heads around, the treatment of women being the most obvious one? How are we supposed to believe that it's going to be any different?
Well, look, I really think what, you know, if you remember the Vietnam negotiations, they took 3 or 4 years. If you think of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan, it took 6 years to negotiate that between the Americans and the Soviets, ending in 1989. Now, you know, clearly negotiations between the Americans and Karzai on one side and the Taliban on the other is not something that can be done in 1 month or 2 months or on what I call an American timetable. In other words, a rush timetable. It has to be done on an Afghan timetable. And what is needed here is there are going to be extremely sensitive and difficult negotiations. For example, the Taliban are still insisting that any power sharing has to be done, you know, that they still want a full Islamic system in Afghanistan.
Sharia law.
Sharia law. Now, certainly the Karzai side and the urban Afghans are not going to accept that. But the whole point of these negotiations are you have to expose the Taliban to, first of all, the world. I mean, the Taliban have been locked up, you know, in their safe havens in Pakistan. They have not really seen the changes that have happened. Secondly, they haven't been exposed to this new generation of Afghans. They haven't been exposed to the fact that there are 3 million girls in school in Afghanistan. You know, they haven't been exposed to the fact that there are tens of thousands of women who are working now in Afghanistan as teachers, as doctors, as nurses, etc. Now, you know, all this requires negotiations, exposure. I mean, I certainly hope that if this office had opened in Qatar, you would get streams of Afghan delegations, including teachers and women and elders and all sorts of people coming to meet with the Taliban. So what I'm trying to say here is that the negotiations themselves are an educative process for the Taliban. And you could lessen this conflict between, you know, an Islamic system and a modern constitution, which Afghanistan has now. You could lessen that whole clash, if you like, between two completely opposite ideas by exposing the Taliban to what is happening.
But you firmly believe that the Taliban are an important part of the solution. We've traditionally viewed them as the problem, but now you believe that they are essential to peace in Afghanistan?
My essential message in this book is that if the Americans leave Afghanistan without a deal, some kind of peace deal with the Taliban, you will be asking for trouble. The danger then is of a breakdown in Afghanistan, a civil war, Al-Qaeda possibly coming back and up, you know, taking up, putting up shop again in Afghanistan. So what is needed is a deal that obviously has to involve Pakistan as well, but essentially a deal which ends the war. In other words, you can't leave Afghanistan in a state of civil war. Unfortunately, one of the things that is happening, if you look at the media, and now in Chicago next week, we've got the NATO summit, and the Americans and NATO are like discussing this transition, that somehow, you know, American forces will leave, and this new Afghan army that has been trained by the Americans will somehow take their place and carry on fighting. Well, it can't happen like that. The Afghan army, as you know, Chris, is riddled with drugs, illiteracy, desertions, incompetence. I mean, this is not an army that can suddenly take on a whole war and stand up to the Taliban.
So are we wasting money by spending these billions of dollars on training them?
No. I think you need an Afghan army, and certainly, you know, it will improve its performance as time goes by. But it cannot be plunged into a war. It can be used to maintain a ceasefire, which is all. It can be used to, you know, maintain a peace deal. But I don't think it can be used to fight a war in the way that the Americans are fighting the war right now in Afghanistan. So what we need is a deal, and then we need to use the Afghan army to implement that deal in an atmosphere of relative peace and calm, not in an atmosphere of war and confrontation. So, I mean, the bottom line here is that, you know, you can only leave Afghanistan in some state of peace. If you leave Afghanistan in the present state of war, there will be, enormous repercussions for the whole region, and ultimately for the United States as well.
Is there not a fear, though, if you look historically in Afghanistan, war has, I mean, what's the longest peace period that there's been in Afghanistan in the last 50 years? I mean, how many Afghan leaders have died peacefully of old age in their bed, as you point out?
That's a very good question. Not many, but, you know, but you know, there was in the 20th century, there was a very long period of peace. After the British left India, there was almost 50 years of peace. And the Soviets and the Americans, you know, Afghanistan was one of the few places in the 50s, after the Second World War, where the Soviets and the Americans actually had aid programs, both helped the Afghans, and were able to do so without confrontation. So, you know, Afghanistan was this kind of backwater of the Cold War, before, of course, the Soviet invasion. It was a backwater in which both countries, both superpowers, were involved in helping. So it has had, you know, in this century, a period of peace. But obviously, once the communist coup took place, and then followed rapidly by the Soviet invasion in 1979, ever since then, Afghanistan has been in a state of war.
So fast forward 2 years, NATO forces have left. What does peace look like in Afghanistan?
I think peace would look like a power-sharing deal between the Taliban and the government. Don't forget, we're going to have presidential elections in Afghanistan in 2014. Karzai can't stand because he's had two terms. There will have to be a new president. I hope there will be a new president.
Are there any promising candidates out there?
Yes, I mean, I think there are several. I mean, both in the opposition and in members of the present cabinet. I think it will be a wide open race, because this time people know that Karzai is not there. So it's going to be, you know, I think a lot of people will stand to be president. There's already a couple of women have already announced that they're going to stand. So, so I think, you know, what peace will look like would be, what would power sharing look like? Well, it would look like you would probably give Taliban control in some of the southern provinces where they come from. So the governor, the police chief, and other sort of dignitaries from that province, from these provinces, would probably be given to the Taliban. There would be Taliban representation in the central government, in the cabinet. But the resources and the money would still be, the aid and Western funds that came in would still be held by the center. And obviously then, you know, the Taliban would have to compromise, because you have a national educational system which has 8 million children in school right now. The Taliban would have to agree to that, you know, and they would have to allow education to continue in the provinces that they would be governing and ruling, and they would be receiving money from the center for that. So, I mean, I think what I'm trying to say here is that, you know, there would be, perhaps there would be some compromises, perhaps there would be some changes to the constitution. But again, I think what the moderate Taliban want is to form be allowed to form a political party. And they could run for parliament, you know.
Obviously, none of this can happen without Pakistan getting on board. To what extent, I mean, we've seen a certain tiny little improvement in the relationship in just the last weeks. We've had a lot of American ambassadors of various sorts visiting and discussions ongoing about reopening those NATO supply routes again. But are you optimistic that Pakistan will play a positive role in the future of Afghanistan?
Look, I'm very fearful, first of all, of the internal crisis within Pakistan. And that is really serious. We have a complete economic meltdown. We have no energy right now. We have no gas. Electricity shut off 18 hours a day. Industry has literally collapsed because of that. And all this is to do with bad management, corruption, the lack of investment in infrastructure. And, you know, I in my book, I try and ask the question, you know, how did we get into such a mess? And really, I go back to the end of the Cold War, where we really never take advantage of the 90s and all the benefits that happened at the end of the Cold War, where countries stood up and improved their trade relations with their neighbors and introduced new industries and globalization and all these other things. That everything passes Pakistan by. And instead, Pakistan is involved in two wars. We are through fundamentalists and extremists, the military is supporting the Kashmiris in India, and at the same time, we're supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan. So rather than benefit from what was happening in the 90s, and of course after 9/11, there's this huge splurge of Western aid for Pakistan. Pakistan received something like $20 billion in 10 years after 9/11. And yet, 80% of that money goes to the military. Hardly any of that money goes to the civil sector and to the economy and to other things. So, frankly, you know, the internal crisis has been created by Pakistanis. And what is needed is an internal, we need to internalize this and be able to discuss this and be able to lay the blame on ourselves for this failure. Not to lay the blame on the Americans. What is happening now, unfortunately, is that every internal crisis is also being blamed on the Americans, or on India, or on, you know, outsiders, which is not the case.
Do you think the Americans are doing the same thing to a certain extent, blaming everything on Pakistan?
I think there is that tendency, because the war is going on. There are still these dramatic attacks in Kabul by the Taliban, etc. And when the Americans can't find any, you know, excuse for being able to defend the city properly, many Pakistanis believe that, you know, Pakistan is being blamed for everything that is going wrong in Afghanistan. The fact is that, you know, a lot of American decision-making in Afghanistan has been wrong. There have been bad decisions taken, even by the Obama administration, you know, which I've talked about. But unfortunately, the tendency of especially the U.S. military has been to blame everything on Pakistan.
The way you speak about Pakistan, you're incredibly outspoken and very critical. And it's not a secret that the Journalists Committee for Protection of Journalists has said that Pakistan is one of the most dangerous places for journalists in the world. And it wasn't long ago that an investigative journalist was killed in Pakistan under somewhat mysterious circumstances. I have to ask you, are you ever at all concerned about being so outspoken? Have you ever been intimidated by any government or security forces in any way?
Well, I have quite a lot. I mean, I've had, the first death sentence that was given me was in 1986 by Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, one of the Mujahideen leaders who was fighting the Soviets, because he thought I was too critical of him. And since then, there have been various death sentences that have been passed on me, most recently by the Pakistani Taliban, which is this force of, Taliban copycats who have now arisen in Pakistan and are leading the insurgency in Pakistan. But at the same time, the really big risk has been, the military, the intelligence agencies, they have become extremely sensitive now to any kind of criticism about their performance. And for example, this journalist you mentioned, Salim Shahzad, was killed. He was tortured and killed. And he certainly blamed. Before his death, he'd sent several notes to people saying that if I'm killed, you know, I would blame the army's intelligence agency, the ISI. And he, 8 journalists have been killed in the last year in Pakistan. 8 journalists were killed, or 7 journalists were killed the year before. And so there is a lot of intimidation, and I really put it down to this, you know, domestic crisis that we are facing. We are facing an external crisis because of, you know, the Americans, because of and other issues, and we're facing this internal crisis. And neither the politicians nor the military are able to come up with any reasonable, what I would call modernist solutions to the internal crisis. For example, the economy desperately needs economic reform. But neither the political parties, nor the political elite, nor the military is willing to carry these economic reforms out. We need to end the kind of feudal system that we still have. We need to end the fact that only 2% of Pakistanis pay income tax. You know, we need to end. We need to raise revenue. We need to stop depending on foreign loans and handouts from outside. All this can only be done if, you know, governments are prepared to make bold and tough decisions.
Do you think Pakistan is in danger of becoming a failed state?
Well, you know, there are the institutions in Pakistan, the army, the bureaucracy, the judiciary. They are pretty broken, but they're still very much intact. And I don't think you become a failed state until your institutional framework actually collapses. And I think we're very far from that. The army certainly is still very coherent. I don't see the institutional collapses happening very. You know, I think the symptoms of a failed state are certainly there. The failure of the economy, the failure of education, the failure of providing jobs to young people. 60% of Pakistanis are under 25. And there's a huge, as you can imagine, rate of joblessness. But at the same time, if there is going to be change in Pakistan, it'll come from young people, because they are really fed up with the existing situation. Young people today are critical of the military, they're critical of the political parties, they're critical of the fundamentalists. They want change. Now, they don't have a voice necessarily, they don't have a leadership, but they are very active in expressing their views.
So coming back full circle to the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan, can the marriage be saved, or are we headed for divorce?
No, I think the marriage has to be saved. I mean, let me put it like that. I don't think, the extract you read at the beginning, neither side can afford to dump the other. Certainly, the U.S. in its withdrawal from Afghanistan needs a stable Afghanistan and needs a stable Pakistan, which is going to be a help in Afghanistan and not a hindrance. At the same time, you know, Pakistan was an ally of the Americans throughout the Cold War. Pakistan's entire window to the West has been through Washington. It can't, whether you talk about loans or money or aid or weapons or technology or industry or investment or anything, it was essentially through Washington. Now, Pakistan can't abandon the United States just like that. 90% of Pakistanis do not want to end up like North Korea or like Iran or like one of these states. I mean, we want to be part of the modern world. We want to be part of the region. We want to have trade, investment, etc., and build a modern economy. The fact that the political elite is basically so gutless at the moment also can't last forever, because there's enormous pressure now on the political elite that, look, if you're not going to take the tough decisions that are needed, then get out of the way and allow, you know, a new political establishment to come into being. And I think young people are really pushing for that. So I think, certainly there is a future for the United States and for Pakistan. And there has to be.
Final question, just quickly. What is the next essential step towards remedying that relationship?
I think the essential step is that the talks that the Americans are having with the Taliban, they must also now involve Pakistan as well. The Americans have to find a way to bring Pakistan or bring consultations with Pakistan into this dialogue. Not necessarily for Pakistan to be at the table, but Pakistan has to be, if you like, part of the process. There has to be a diplomatic process whereby, you know, this can happen. I think that would build confidence in Pakistan that the Americans want Pakistan as part of the solution. They don't want to keep Pakistan out of the picture.
Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for this most illuminating and interesting conversation.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. You're wonderful. Thank you very much.